Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoints. This is MJ Network, after my sister, Marcia Joyce, who I miss every single day of the week. And we're going to have a phenomenal show, I could tell you that. Author Gerard de Moreni is here, and we're going to talk about his book, Project New Detroit. And that is absolutely going to be fantastic. But let me warn you that it's freezing up here in Upper Westchester. So this show is going to, you know, warm you up and make you happy. And you don't have to be outside. You can listen and ask questions on my Facebook wall. And we're going to talk about it. Kevin Matthews, brother of Carl, the Watchman Agency's Vice President of Government Relations, presenting his dream, the hometown renovation plan titled Project New Detroit, to Chris De Niro and others when a friend from his past burst into the VIP-only meeting. Antonio Brown, a former drug dealer who grew up with Kevin, shocks everyone with the gruesome photos of his son murdered in a stealth favored by Islamic terrorists. Brown asked De Niro for justice, and I'm not going to tell you anymore. The author is going to tell you himself. Good morning. How you doing?
Good, Fran.
This is good. I was thinking, I think too much sometimes, they tell me. Before we talk about this book, by the way, all your books are good. This is my favorite.
Oh, great. And excellent.
It was my favorite, basically, also because you left the end. It was perfect. It made sense. It absolutely made sense to me. So I take it, there's going to be a sequel soon, I think.
Yes, that's what I'm working on right now.
Oh,
we have the sequel to New Detroit is White Widow. And when you read the book, you find out that the White Widow is the antagonist in New Detroit. So
she's good though. She's really evil. I like her. Not really. So the first book, The Watchmen, from the Watchmen Group series, was related to something that happened at 9/11. So you'd give us the backstory of why you created this book to start with, and why you created the Watchmen Group, and how that impacted you. So I thought that was important.
Yeah, Chris De Niro is the main character, and he was a hedge fund manager in New York. He was a self-made success. He grows to be a billionaire in the hedge fund world, and then on September 11th, he loses his wife and his unborn son, his third son, in the North Tower of the World Trade Center. And I basically wrote that because of the loss of a number of friends, my wife and mine, and in the North Tower. And so I created Chris De Niro to do what, you know, a lot of us who survived and lost friends and were dealing with survivor guilt couldn't do, which is to help people that are being terrorized. And that's where the whole thought came from, the whole idea came from for Chris De Niro. And he ends up buying a lackluster counterterrorism agency, and he renames it the Watchman Agency out of a line in the Bible. He calls it that which is the name of the first book. The Watchman of Ephraim comes from the prophet Hosea, and Ephraim is the symbolic United States in prophecy. And so he's the Watchman. He sets himself up as as a person who's going to take all of his money and put all of his efforts, and he builds a great team, and that becomes the members of the Watchman Agency, and they have a paramilitary arm called Archangel, and they, you know, together, that's where they launched, and that was back in 2011, as you remember. You were one of the first people to read the book, I think.
That's right.
You and Marcia. And, you know, from there, now we're, you know, we're fast forward to the new book that just came out, New Detroit, and that's a story about Chris being called to Detroit by one of the members of the Watchman Agency. His vice president of governmental affairs, Carla Matthews, her brother, is trying to start a new area. You know, we all know what happened to Detroit over the last 20, 30 years. And so here he is inviting, a billionaire, Chris De Niro, to come in and invest. And they're going to set up a new area, and the whole idea of his project, New Detroit, is, you know, they're going to build residents and they're going to build businesses and they're going to try to build that inner city of New Detroit. But right in the beginning, they find out that there's something really, really evil going on in that area, which, you know, all of the books that I write are based, you know, they have aspects of what's really going on, of facts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a real, you know, real concern that that ISIS terrorism and Islamic extremism has gotten into some of the inner cities in the United States. That's where they basically feed on. They feed on in the world on
mm-hmm.
poor, impoverished, young men mostly. And they it's just basically like street gangs. You know, I come from the inner city of Brooklyn. You know, street gangs offered these, you know, young people identity. You know, you get to be part of something bigger than you, and that's really where they recruit. And so that's what Chris is dealing with in Detroit. And it's a fun story. I think you liked it. You say that you enjoyed it. What was your favorite part of it?
This was amazing, because when Antonio Brown walks in and he's going to do something awful and he shows them this picture, it sort of sets it in motion. And I'm going like, why is this man here? How come they didn't stop him? And then, of course, I remember two weeks ago in Tribeca, and somebody coming in and just killing all those people, mowing them down in a truck. And, yeah, that was an Islamic terrorist. And, unfortunately, it feels like it was in my backyard. And I did a show about that last week with several law enforcement people, that we talked about that, Las Vegas and the Texas murders. That was absolutely horrendous. So, I mean, just the beginning of it, and saying, okay, Antonio Brown, what is he going to do? Is he going to kill them? Is he going to do something? It sort of sets it in motion.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting part of New Detroit is I started writing it in 2014. And that's when Michael Greenberg had reached out to me, the creative MacGyver and Stargate, and said, hey, listen, I love these Chris De Niro books. I want to write the screenplays, and I also have some other projects, TV and movie projects, that I want you to work on. So I you know, put all my efforts into writing with Mike over the last couple of years, and sure enough, I never finished the New Detroit. And so now it came to 2017, I said, listen, okay, now I've written about a half dozen of these TV and the movie scripts, and they're all under development and taken off.
Mm-hmm.
I have the time to finish New Detroit. Well, everybody came. It just so happened that we had domestic terrorism after domestic terrorism incidents.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm getting literally thousands of letters coming in saying this book couldn't have been timed better. I wish I could let people know that, you know, oh yeah, I was a genius. That's not really how it happened. I had domestic terrorism has always been, there's the threat of it has been out there, but we started having these incidences as the book was released. So, it was just that kind of timing, you know. I couldn't have done that if I tried, you know.
Yeah, you couldn't. I mean, just what's going on in the last 2 months is scary. And
yeah,
I'm going to be doing a show on December 12th with former FBI agent Michael Tabman. And we're going to be talking about domestic terrorism. We're going to also be talking about what's happening in the schools in New York City and everywhere, where there's no metal detectors and where it's dangerous and where things have been happening in the middle schools. And unfortunately, the murder that took place last month was in the school that I went to when I was younger.
Oh, boy.
And it wasn't much better back then, and it's worse now. And it broke my heart that somebody went into the school and that the mayor of New York couldn't understand that you need metal detectors in schools, unfortunately. So we've got Chris De Niro has two sons, and he has to keep them in protective custody. How come? I mean, it must get to them after a while. They're really great kids, but it must get to them like they want to break loose.
Yeah, in the first book, Chris kind of, you know, put himself out there. I mean, people, he was a high-profile character like many of the hedge fund people. So, let's say in the business world, he would have been pretty well-known. You know, he would be very well-known. It's like an Eddie Lampert, the guy that's running Sears now. He bought Sears. Eddie Lampert is kind of Chris Nero would be very similar to Eddie Lampert or Anthony Scaramucci, those kind of guys that came out of New York and made themselves billions of dollars. So he was kind of well known. Then he opens up this Watchman agency, and in the first book, there's a major terrorist event, and it's the Watchman agency that kind of mm-hmm. saves the day. So consequently, he becomes famous and a target. And he was a target in the first book, and so he wants to keep his sons protected. It's funny you said that it's ironic that you said that you're having that show and talking about that incident in the school mm-hmm. because one of the upcoming book plots I have is about terrorism coming to a major university, because the boys now mm-hmm. Chris De Niro's boys are both in college, so. They age at the exact same rate as my own oldest two sons, and mm-hmm. that's kind of an easy way for a writer to keep track of characters, is you kind of pattern their age or after people mm-hmm. that are around you, so that I can never forget how old Chris's sons are, because my own sons are the same age and they're away at college. So that's going to be that could very well be a new Chris book coming up.
That would be interesting. I text my nephew every Friday to drive him crazy because it's fun, and he's in college, and he loves when I do that. And I texted him about 3 weeks ago, and he said, I have to tell you, don't get upset. We had a bomb threat and a terrorist threat in the school. He says, it happens all the time. I go, really? Oh, my God. Call me up right now. I want to hear your voice. Okay? And they cleared out the school, and he was in a restaurant with his friends, thank God. And he just said, it happens all the time. It's scary. The school that he goes to is fantastic. And they did something. I said, now I'm getting nervous. I can't wait to see you for Thanksgiving because I want to make sure you're okay. Because it's
right.
scary. He said, yeah, it happens all the time. In the school where I taught, we had a couple of, false bomb threats, but there were a couple of disgruntled adults. What can you do? So talk about the Watchmen. The people you created in the Watchman organization are really interesting. Who are the main people there? I mean, there are so many of them, and I like all of them, but I like Richie and Muggsy. I like Muggsy the best. Sorry.
Yeah, we just had a conversation with, right now, the Watchman, the script that we wrote for the Watchman is over at Legendary Entertainment, and we have conversations with Herb Gaines over there, and one of the fun aspects of the whole series is the secondary characters are mm-hmm. I think as interesting as Chris. So Chris basically is not a military guy, he's not going to be the when you read a Brad Thor novel or a Clancy novel, he doesn't have the military background. So, but what he is he's a really really smart businessman, and he's from an inner city. He's from New York, and so he's smart and he's savvy, and he surrounds himself with great people. The first person he picks is his brother-in-law, his wife's mm-hmm. His deceased wife's brother, Muggsy Richie, who was a Navy SEAL. So he puts him in a position of being the president of the agency, and from there, he picks people that will work for. Remember, he kind of acquires the counterterrorism agency and turns it into the Watchman. So there were people on staff there already. He just promotes the ones that were real shining stars, gets rid of the political correctness, and mm-hmm. and just promotes people on their abilities. And so Michelle Wang rises to the top of his mm-hmm. the spy attack department, and. He has Scipio is a character that comes in the second book, becomes the head of the paramilitary unit. And Scipio is a Delta Force guy, so he's really bouncing off the wall. He's probably the most nefarious of the good guys in the stories.
I like him.
And
then, he's one of my favorites.
Yeah, Scipio has his own fan base. Each character has their fan base. That's with New Detroit. That was the first book centered around Carla Matthews. There were people over the last 7 years that said, hey, listen, we know a lot about Michelle Wang from the earlier books and Scipio from the earlier books and, of course, Chris. What about this woman, Carla? And so Carla, now we know the backstory with Carla is that she's from Detroit. And, you know, she's an African-American woman who rose up in the government, and Chris sees the potential in her and puts her in charge of the governmental affairs. And what I like about the characters, too, is that they're not – this is not all cookie-cutter. So these are not all sycophants. You know, they're not surrounding Chris and telling him he's right all the time. As a matter of fact, a lot of times they're correcting him. You know, they're saying, hey, you know, they have different political beliefs, but – what I wanted to remove was the real animosity from the left and the right and all the political things and you know, accentuate the core that people, righteous people in the United States want the best for the country. And you can have different views, but if you work together, and I think that's one of the sub-themes of Chris De Niro, is that the Watchmen agency makes, and then people, that's when I get, when people write in, they're not really talking about as much every, you know, specific story, but they really tell me about how the books made them feel. And they said, you know, this is a good case, a good example of Americans working together. You know, you have black and white and Chinese and this and that. You have people on the right, people on the left. You have, you know, screw-ups. You have, you know, shining stars. In the Watchmen agency and in the Chris De Niro universe, they're working together, and that's really that's the fun. That's the fun for me, you know. You have all this. You have the whole melting pot of the United States working together in the Watchmen agency.
Well, I think I got that in my 10,000 word review. I went a little overboard, but that's okay. But I didn't give anything away. I have to admit, this was very upsetting. I wrote the review, and then it disappeared. It literally disappeared off my computer. And I'm saying to myself yesterday, "What? I have the questions. Where's the review?" So I wrote it over. It took me all day yesterday to write it over. And my last sentence, I'm going to post this on Amazon if they don't mind my 10,000 million words, because I'm not going to delete any of it because I really think that I've outdone myself.
So you found it, in other words. You found it.
I wrote it over. I literally wrote it over from scratch.
I wonder you don't sleep, friend.
Yeah, I said, you know what? I don't know why. You know, I quoted some stuff, and I said, you know, where's Saeed? I couldn't stand him. Said, is paradise beautiful? Well, when, you know, what can I say? I don't know. I don't want to know. But at the ending I wrote, author Gerard de Moreni presents a 5-star blockbuster novel that focuses on hate, religious differences, power, control, hope, and the desire to create a better Detroit. And, of course, it says, will
it
succeed?
It.
And I didn't.
You nailed it. It's that I love the word hope. You know, not enough hope in a lot of the stories that come out.
Yeah.
I mean, we focus a lot on the movies and TV shows and stuff like that. Focus on the violence, and you know, but where's the hope? And you know, that's really what I want. Good. I did something right. If that's the feeling you got from the books.
That and a whole bunch more people. So let's talk about Tonio, because I like this character. He developed better. I was getting worried about him, and his son is killed. So he approaches Chris in a very unique way. So why does he say he'll help him? Why does he agree? Because this starts off the chain of events.
Antonio Brown is he's really not a good guy. He's a guy that was a former drug dealer in Detroit, and he grew up with Caller's brother, Kevin. And Kevin is the man that wants to do this whole Project New Detroit. So he basically shows up on the doorstep of the money raise party that Kevin Matthews was throwing in the beginning of the story. And it just so happened that, you know, he shows up and he wants to he knows that Chris De Niro is there. I mean, you know, it would have been known that, you know, a guy that was going to be, you know, investing tens of millions of dollars that would be in the local news. So Tonio knows that Chris De Niro is there, and his ulterior motive, other than connecting with his childhood friend Kevin Matthews, is I need help. He knew he needed help. Something terrible happens to his son, and he's a guy from the streets, and he knows that this isn't the normal drug thing. This something else is going on here, which you find out, you know, from what Kevin brings from what Tonio brings to Kevin at that meeting. And so that's really why Tonio broke in there and just says, hey, listen, you know, there was bad blood between Kevin and Tonio. You know, one guy went one way and went to school and becomes a lawyer and was going to become the mayor of Detroit. We find out Kevin Matthews wanted to become the mayor, but instead he thought he could help through the private sector to revitalize the city. And here's Tonio, who, you know, went to jail, was a drug dealer. And had a lot of bad things happen to him and his family, and that's I base that off of, you know, again, I'm from the inner city, and I worked in Brownville and in Canarsie, and some of the nicknames for the characters in New Detroit come from my childhood, come from the people that I worked with and from that area. So, you know, people like the nickname for Tonio was Shah, and that was a drug dealer that worked in a factory that my dad owned. So that's where Tonio came from, and that's the beginning of the story. That's the beginning of New Detroit. Is Tonio's coming with a real, you know, with something really bad that happened to his son, and he knows he needs help. He's smart enough to know that, hey, this isn't normal. You know, something's really wrong here.
My dad grew up in Brownsville. No wonder he was so tough.
it was a really, really tough area. It's where Mike Tyson's from, and we had some of Tyson's family that worked in the factory. We were on East 91st Street and Ditmas Avenue, right on the borderline of Brownsville and Canarsie. And tough, I mean, you know, bad, tough area. I got to see, people that were a whole society of people that were, you know, living a lifestyle that people, I don't think, you know, most of Americans even know. When you have to come from an inner city, then you know. I don't even have to explain it to
know.
You. You know, if you're from New York, then you understand. But if you're not from a big city, especially an inner city, and to see the poverty and the crime and everything else, the breakdown of the family and all that, I try to put that into the books.
Yeah, it is.
You know.
It's scary because he worked in a mattress factory. He had to drop out of college because my grandfather died, he told me. So he wound up working in a mattress factory from the black market. So I said, that must have been very interesting. I grew up in the South Bronx, so I understand. So let's talk about this mosque and what was behind it and how did they get so many people, these young people like Terrell, who's going to come into it. He's another character that you can bring back. That would be okay with me. And so how did you get started with this mosque and how they were behind what's about to happen?
Well, that's where Islamic extremists that's where they recruit from. They recruit from the mosques. So not all mosques are bad, but there are mosques that allow these terrorist organizations to infiltrate and to recruit. And they look for, like I said, they normally are not looking for really rich kids that have something better to do. They're looking for people that come from bad neighborhoods that have very low education, very low money, very low opportunity, and they step in there and they allow them. It's really the template of every criminal organization. There's really very little when you look at how a terrorist organization recruits. They utilize the same tried and true methods that the mafia use, that street gangs use. It's, hey, you should be part of something bigger. They sell them on a dumb ideology. The ideology, I mean, if you ask most of these terrorists around the world to quote the scriptures that they get for killing other people, they're always wrong. They're always incorrect.
I know.
So it really all they're doing is they're kind of skimming over that, and they're selling an ideology of hate. And by the way, it's real easy to make a 16-year-old hate, okay, because they're teenagers and they're boys and they're filled with testosterone and they got nothing to do, you know. And that's who they're. So that's where the Detroit mosque came from. And you know, when I write, I actually pull up maps and stuff, and so I picked you know, I picked, you know, a mosque. I didn't, you know, I picked a mosque real near, and, it, you know, people would have to go to Detroit to see how incredibly destroyed the area. I mean, it looks like a bomb dropped on mm-hmm. Central Northern Detroit, you know. So it was, you know, I had some people write in and they're going, hey, you know, I'm really from Texas. I heard Detroit's that bad, but are you like painting that? I said, no, I'm not painting that any worse than what it is. You know, I mean, this, you have no idea. I show people pictures. You know, I don't write picture books, but when they ask, I'll reply in an email with photos. And I said, I didn't make these photos. These are the photos that I used when I wrote the book.
I wonder what would happen if you put them in the book. You know, there was something on the news this morning where they were defacing and destroying mosques in Brooklyn and up here, and that just hit home with this book. So we have Khan, and we have Saeed. We have a whole bunch of people on that team. So who is Khan, and who are the others? And then we have this kid, Terrell. And how does he come upon being part of this? And why do they think that he killed Tony Osun?
Well, Saeed Malik and Khan are actually, well, Khan, I kind of left ambiguous because we don't always
yeah.
know where these guys are. So some people are coming from the Middle East, and they're coming and they infiltrate, mm-hmm. and then they end up in the United States. And they're soldiers. They're basically soldiers. So Khan is basically a soldier. He kind of has loyalties to the imam of that really bad mosque.
Mm-hmm.
Saeed Malik is a native Detroit person. So he came up. He's a Muslim who gets converted inside the mosque into this terrorist ideology. So that's the nature of domestic terrorism, is that these people are Americans, all right? So he's born and raised in New York, and next thing in Detroit, and the next thing you know, he's running a cell of ISIS, and they're basically recruiting and they're training, you know, these young people. They're getting the flow of people like Terrell. And Terrell was a friend of the son of Tonio. And so these were just kids. They were high school. They played football. They end up, for whatever reason, the mosque is right across the street from the park that they played in, or they're recruiting from the park. And next thing, you know, it's just one thing leads to another. The kids go into the mosque. They start listening. And next thing you know, they're growing inside a terrorist organization. They don't even really, I don't even think they fully realize the implications of, you know, what they're doing. They're just, they're coming out of a system. It's almost like boot camp. It's like Marine, you know, you go into boot camp and you come out a Marine in 16 weeks. Well, that's what the recruiters do. They take a little longer. They get into an ideology, but the bottom line, they come out and they're ready to, that's where you get their suicide bombers from. That's where you get, you know, that's where you get these terrorists from. So that's really the setup. There's an infrastructure in Detroit of Islamic terrorists, and that's what the book is based. You know, is telling the story of Chris De Niro just happening to go there to help the area, and he comes across this entire sub. It's not even a culture. This sub terrorist, you know, cell. And they're planning something. So he kind of steps into it. You know, that happens in Chris De Niro books. It's not always all planned mm-hmm. out, and you know, it's not Mission Impossible, and they know what's going on from the beginning. They sometimes, in the case of New Detroit, the good guys are finding out along the way what's going on here. You know.
Well, what scared me, and now what made the book believable and realistic, more realistic, is that they're in the hotel. And they're eating dinner, and then somebody rings a bell for dessert, and then they get blindsided. How did that happen? Why did you create it like that? I was like, and then they put them in this airless basement, and I had to literally take a drink of water and have some water with me for the rest of the book to make sure that I wasn't, seriously. I mean, an airless basement, no air. They're dying of thirst. There's nothing there. There's a camera watching them, and I'm saying, let me go get a wet towel. Let me go get something on my head. And let me go get a bottle of water, seriously, because I was, like, claustrophobic. So how did you create that, and how come you traded where they got blindsided, which made sense? by the way.
Yeah, because, well, the tempo of the story was that Chris De Niro, Muggsy Richie, and Johnny F., their CIO, the guy that's in charge of the technology, are not in Detroit for a terrorist operation. They're actually there only because they were invited there to invest in this Project New Detroit. So the beginning of the story is the bad guys come across them and think that there's a potential threat here. You know, it just so happened that you had the head of one of the top counterterrorism agencies in town right when they were about to launch a major terrorist operation. And so the terrorists actually take the first move. And that's why they kind of catch Chris De Niro and his people, by surprise, because they're not even there. They're not even expecting that. And so when they take them out of there, they bring them to that basement, that whole beat that you're talking about. Like I said, I'm the type of writer. My partner Mike Greenberg said, you're a natural born director and a natural born script writer. I never thought of this because I really do like to write novels and I'm a novel reader. But the way I write is very visual. So I have all my screens and I actually looked at different basements in that part of Detroit, mm-hmm. and that's where that whole scene, that whole location, I built the location out of actually what's there. I mean, I could bring you to the spot. I give enough information in the book where you could look it mm-hmm. up on Google and you'll see exactly where that beat took place. Now, is that basement there? Yeah, I mean, are there terrorists there? I hope not, But yeah, those locations are there. So I retold it and said, hey, this is where they would have brought them, and I'm gonna play the scene out. The way I write is, I don't come up with an idea and then try to fit facts into it. I present the facts. I'm presented with facts. I use the locations and everything else, and then I drop the characters into it so that it's really real. And it's a little bit of a challenge on the writing side because I'm not solving the problems before I write the scenes. But then I think it makes for better, for more exciting scenes, because that's really what I would have done if I was the terrorist guy. That's exactly where I would have brought them, you know.
Well, actually, I looked up some of the airless basements, and that's when I needed some more water. And a window open. I was like, it was so well pictured and so well described that I felt, and I could feel, Kevin's pain, and I could feel what was happening with Carla getting upset, and you could feel the tension in the room, and the fact that they were all taped up made it even worse, and I'm going, oh my God, that's even worse. They can't move, and just the fact if they ever get out. So how does Tonio get involved with Scipio? This was so cool. And how did he get in the Iman's face, and what can I say? How did you create that, and how did he manage to get involved with Scipio without Scipio knocking him off and thinking that he was bad? Because working together was priceless.
Well, without giving away too much of the real fun of the book, obviously they do. They finally get the, because Scipio's not there. So Scipio's not even in Detroit. Yeah. Scipio's back in Las Vegas where Archangel and where Chris De Niro live. And they're gonna try to reach out as soon as they can. So once they're taken captive by the terrorists, their whole idea is, number one, we have to get out of that basement that you're talking about. They have to, it's heavily fortified, and they're prisoners in there. They weren't expecting to be there. They're not prepared for a terrorist. This wasn't their plan. This had nothing to do with any plan. They just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, or the right place at the right time. So then when they get word out, and of course, who are they contacting? They're contacting the head of their paramilitary arm, which is Scipio. He's in charge of Archangel. He's in charge of the Watchmen's, military. They have three, they have Michael and Gabriel and Patio squads. So they're fashioned after SEAL teams. So when they dispatch and try to get Scipio to come on, come, the one person that's trying, that's outside of the captives, is this kid. And you know, he was friends with the boy who was murdered, you know, Antonio Brown's son. And so he now, it's almost as if he had cold water thrown in his face. He kind of knew it beforehand. We know from the story that he's already come to the point that, hey, what am I part of here? I mean, this isn't what I want to be part of. But, you know, just like in the mafia, just like in street gangs, once you're in, you're in. They don't let you out, especially if you know anything about their inner workings, the people that are involved, or their plans. This kid, Terrell, knew. So he's working on the outside trying to help them, but he's more or less just a young man. So when Scipio comes to town finally, the only person that can really reach out to him is Terrell. So, and I love, again, I write scenarios that I love to read, and I love when you take, you know, instead of having all these military people and this and that, let's play it out. This young man has to make contact with Scipio, doesn't know him from Adam, and Scipio, you know, if you read the other books, you know that Scipio is kind of almost a little scary in his manner and his personality. So it's fun to see, you know, a young African American from the inner city who's dealing with all this stuff, and the guy he has to reach out to is this crazy Delta Force guy who's coming into town and saying, "Okay, listen, we're gonna take care of business now." So that's where that whole thing comes from.
Yeah, I like this kid, and I like Scipio. I like him, one of the best characters. He's my kind of person. He's the kind of person that'll have your back. You need him. Yeah, seriously. So we learn about Nahid, and we learn about the Ayman, and the White Widow, she doesn't tell us about it. She doesn't flinch, nothing. Nothing seems to bother her. And no matter what, and of course she's having a little fun with one of the other guys, and she takes her diversions out. So how did you create the White Widow? I mean, she's so real. She could be any terrorist. And usually they say it's male terrorists. Well, she's really awful and evil. How did you create her? And why doesn't anything really bother her? And she wouldn't even hesitate to kill her group. She doesn't care.
I didn't create the White Widow. The White Widow is a real person.
I know.
And she's out there, Samantha. And she is a person that... She's a British, you know, Caucasian British national woman who was converted to Islamic extremism, and is probably taking part in. She had a lot to do with money raising, and she had some to do with some of the worst terrorist events over the last 10 years. She got her name because she is able to infiltrate where, you know, dark-skinned Middle Eastern people can't, because if you see her, she speaks with a British accent. She's got, you know, vibrant blue eyes. She's, you know, she's British. She's British in every, you know, in all of her look. And so she is a person that her husband, she was married, and her husband was died in one of the terrorist attacks. There's been word out that she was killed, but then there's other reports that she's still out there. And so I came, you know, I'm looking at, you know, just like everybody else, I'm reading about all these things, and I just was fascinated by this real life, you know, character, this person that's out there, and how she could so easily infiltrate Western, you know, countries, and nobody would ever take a second look at her. She can go in and out of countries, and so that's the person that she went from a money raiser and just part of this thing to a person that organizes terrorist activity and terrorist attacks. And so now it occurred to me, why wouldn't she come here? You know, that was the one of the first questions that I asked myself, you know, when the whole idea for New Detroit came, is why wouldn't somebody like that come here? I mean, as it is, you can get into terrorists can get into our country pretty easily. Imagine if you had somebody that looked like any one of us, you know, any one of the you know, the United States is still predominantly white, Caucasian, you know. So this woman could come in to this country, nobody would suspect anything. And that's what she does in Detroit. We find out that this isn't just being run by a loose terrorist cell. This is being run by somebody who's orchestrated some of the worst terrorist events. And that's where you're going to see, that's where White Widow is going to go. The sequel is actually going to pick up, and it's going to be more centered directly on the White Widow. It's basically a chase. It's a chase because, you know, you're going to find out that the people in the Watchmen, you know, didn't catch her. They didn't catch her in New Detroit. And she's out there, but they don't let anybody get by them, you know, especially a guy like Scipio who, you know, lives for this kind of stuff. He had to make a choice in New Detroit to hold on to her or to save people. And he made his choice, and now, you know, he has to live with it. And that's where White Widow is going to go. That's where the sequel is going to go.
That's what's scary. That really scared me. When that went at the end, but it was a good ending because it made sense for a sequel. But before I forget, because I have them in front of me, Tuesday, the 21st at a special time, the author of Seventh Grade Revolution, which is a phenomenal book for teens, what happens when teens run the school and they run into their own obstacles and how they have to save the school from whatever, is going to, the author will be here at 11 o'clock special time. On the 4th at 10 o'clock, the author of Snifter and Death. And on the 6th of December, one of my favorite people in the whole universe, John Land, will be here with Strong to the Bone. And on the 12th, D.P. Lyle, who consults for CSI and Criminal Minds, will be here for his new novel, A-List. And on the 12th, they'll be doing a special on school safety, metal detectors in schools. And we're going to talk about bullying. And we're going to talk about some of the things that have been happening in the news related to schools and some of the teacher that was taken hostage last month. And on the 19th, I'm going to be meeting with Reese Hirsch, surveillance. And on the 14th, I don't want to forget, New York Times author Bruce Coffin. And that's just with some of what I'm up to this month. And in the new year, we've already booked a few shows. So let's talk about that basement again. And we've got Kevin in there, and Carla, she's upset. So how did you create the scene where if they ever get out of there and I don't need a bottle of water anymore?
I don't come up with the solutions.
Yeah, we know.
before I write them. So when we have writers talks, I give writers talks out here in the West, and you know, I see so many writers they fight with, I wrote myself into a box. I wrote myself into a corner. How do you get out of that, and how do you prevent that? And I saw that some people use, you know, some writers use whole different systems. They'll come up with the solution and then back into the problem. My problem with that is that I find that you kind of come up with pretty mundane problems then. You know, bad people don't come up with, okay, the first thing is how I'm going to get caught. They come up with how I'm not going to get caught. So I use the same premise as bad people. So when I put them in that basement, I put myself in the place of the antagonist, in the place of the White Widow, and the people that are down there, and say, okay, listen, they're really not wanting to have prisoners per se. That they just happened to had to do this. They felt they had to take Chris De Niro and his people hostage, but really they were launching they were right on the eve of launching a major terrorist attack. So they put him in there, and now I go back into the protagonist, I go back into Chris De Niro's world, and I say, okay, now I'm in a room, and this is what they've done, and this is the security, how do I get out of here? And that's where writers think, you know, well, aren't you causing yourself wrote yourself into a box? Well, no, I mean that's where the fun and that's where the work of good writing takes place. Is okay, how do I get out of here? you know, I'm a mechanical engineer. I was a journeyman mechanical engineer in my past. I'm a creative guy, you know, all artists are. So let me use my mind, and what would I do? And that's really what how the way they get out is the way, you know, and utilizing the skill sets and the resources of the characters, not, you know, my own personal ones, but if they're smarter than me, if they have different, you know, Johnny F. is a tech genius. And so, you know, I put him to work, and Chris De Niro is just a guy that can think himself out of just about anything. He's just that kind of, you know, we all know, I mean, we know that there are people out there that are just really smart. They don't have to be a Delta, you know, a SEAL team captain. And that's the fun of Chris De Niro. And I get a lot of readers of other books, which are great because I read them too. You know, the Milk people and the Flynn people and Tom Clancy. And, you know, what they find from the Chris De Niro books is, wow, this is different. This is not the same. These people don't have all the answers. It's not as violent centered. I mean, there's violence that happens, but it's really about the story of these people and dropping these people into these real life situations, and then you know we watch how they get out of them, and that's what happens in that basement. That's how they get out, and they still have to stop the terrorist incident. You know, now they know there's going to be a major terrorist attack, and so there's still more on their plate when they get out. You know.
Well, they wanted to ruin the 4th of July, and that's not right either. So we've got this guy that answers the phone by accident. We've got Vince Ragone, who's another one of the great characters, and he's going to get the coordinates as to where he thinks everybody is. But when they finally get out of the basement, and Vince shows us what happens, and they're going to take they're going to take Kevin to the hospital. So there are people that are after him anyway, right? I got nervous.
Yeah.
I'm saying, oh, my God, now that he's got, I don't have too much claustrophobia, now I get into the back of this car and they're going to try to kill them. That's not right either.
Yeah, that's right. Like, that's exactly right. The mosque is, and again, I use a map. So where this incident takes place and where the mosque is a mile away, so it's very easy for when the main terrorist cell moves out of the basement and they're getting ready to launch the attack, and the people and the watchmen are emerging. They're able to go after them. It's not done. It's still happening. They're still going to try to kill them and take, you know, and get this terrorist attack on at the same time. And so that's fun. And I take the highways. I have the real highways there. I had a bunch of people. I was very very happy that a bunch of people from Detroit. You know, they had this movie Detroit that came out, and then I released New Detroit right after that. And so there was a lot of attention focused on Detroit. And I had a lot of readers that came in and says, hey, you know, I was born and raised in Detroit. I was born and raised in Ann Arbor. I went to school in Detroit, and you got all of the streets right. And the highways right now, hospital. I know that hospital. And so that's always fun for me because I work hard at building that whole, you know, everything around the characters is true. So that's where you start. That's where your mind starts going, did this really happen? You know, that's what makes it fun to read. You know,
well, that's kind, what I mean.
Kind of.
You know, I think if they didn't have problems, and I think if you made it too easy, and I think if nothing bad happened, it would be boring and not believable. And if the characters didn't have some kind of flaws, I mean, I can't find any that Chris has. Mainly, well, sometimes he doesn't listen.
You know, it's that you really hit on something, friend, because one of the main things that where my partner Michael Greenberg came, and here's this big, huge producer and started some of the most iconic TV shows in history. And he came to me and he said, I he got up to chapter 3 in the first book, The Watchmen of Ephraim, and he said, you created a protagonist with the best heart and soul motivation that I've ever seen in 37 years. and of when he turned, you know, he became first became a producer. He's worked with 400 of the best writers in the world in Hollywood. And so I took it as a major, and I'm a huge fan of MacGyver and Stargate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, wow, you know, so what got him out of my stories? It wasn't the action. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't anything like, it wasn't even the skill set of, you know, my guy is a Delta Force, this and that. No, Chris De Niro is what grabbed him. Chris De Niro is what grabs everybody. He's I don't want to say normal guy. He's an extraordinary man, but, you know, and you said, you know, you don't want to make things too easy and this and that. Well, the first thing that ever happens to Chris is he loses his wife. And
that's
I said this to you seven years ago, and it's still the same. The Chris De Niro series is a love story to me. It's an endearing, enduring love story. It's a man who lost his soulmate. And all he's doing is he's focusing his energies. Just like anybody in that suffers from depression, instead of going down a dark tunnel, he's utilizing mm-hmm. his own faith, his own motivations to help people. It's as simple as that. It's not escapism. He's not escaping the pain of losing his wife, but he doesn't have to think about it. So a lot of the stories end with Chris going back to thinking about his wife. The early story certainly did. You know, mm-hmm. It always ends where, you know, everybody else is saved really except for Chris. Chris can't, what happened to Chris happened. So a lot of people that survived, you know, bad things in their life, whether it's abuse or a criminal act or anything else, they get Chris. They really get Chris in the heart. You know, they care about Chris.
Yeah, I understand, because when I lost my sister, the reason I'm doing book reviews is because before she died, she dared me to review something. She dared me to review a cookbook, and I don't cook at all, ever. I don't even know what knob of a stove you use. I don't even know when the gas is on. Terrible. I may be very smart, but, you know, ovens, just forget it. And I wrote a review for somebody, and it spread like wildfire because they said I knew what I was doing. And after that, I said I knew I was cooked because she instigated me. So, you know, every time I write a review like what I wrote yours yesterday, I go, oh, Marcia, can you help me find this on my computer? No, and I could hear in my face ear saying, write it over. It'll be better the second time.
Well, that's beautiful. If you think about it, that's absolutely beautiful. That's the essence of what's beautiful in human life, okay? In our world, and, you know, that's what's beautiful. And that's what – so you have a lot in common with Chris, because that's a motivator for you. That's something that's making you do something. There's the source of the inspiration. That's really where Chris comes from. Chris, so you understand. No wonder you would like the stories, because you and Chris have that in common. That's what's driving the character.
Uh-huh, I did. That's exactly right, because she did. I mean, then I developed the radio station after her. And the first time I did my radio show, I did a radio show. I was reading something, and she calls me up. She said, that was too fast. I go, did I ask you? Do I care? No. Anyway, so we finally come to the realization of what this horrible person wants to do. She wants to take down 10 sites, but we're not going to say whether she does or not. So before we close, tell us a little bit more about the sequel. And I got your email, your private message that said, let's talk about Joshua's Country. What's that about? I ratted you out. There's another book coming, people.
Yes, it's actually releasing this Sunday, and I'm so proud of Joshua's Country. It's the first story that I've published outside of the Chris De Niro universe. It's about cantankerous old cowboy named Joshua Jacobs, and he was a veteran in Vietnam, and he kind of gets he's kind of disillusioned. He goes home to West Texas, and he basically starts as a ranch hand and builds up to an empire. Like a lot of people in West Texas, he was a wildcatter, and he hit oil on his property and becomes very, very wealthy. But at the same point, you know, he was kind of a tough guy. You know, he ran things, you know, the way he wanted to run things. He, you know, he wanted to be left alone by the government, and that's why they nicknamed his big Ponderosa-sized ranch down in West Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the area started calling it Joshua's Country because he made the law, but he finds out that you can't run a family that way. And, you know, we all know that. You know, you think that you could be a big cheese outside of your house, and then you go inside, and I have, you know, four sons. And, yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, okay, daddy, you know. I mean, who's listening, you know. And so Joshua learns a tough lesson that he can't, his family doesn't work the same way as you can run a business or anything else. And the story goes on where his sons serve in the military, which he didn't want. He just wanted them to take over his empire. And one of them gets taken hostage by an ISIS terrorist overseas. And so the story really revolves around his grandson coming home. He loses his son, so he's a man that now his wife had died, and he had lost a son, and all really what he has is his grandson who idolizes him but didn't listen to him and went into the military, and he has his daughter-in-law who really holds him responsible for breaking the family up. So it's really a real dysfunctional situation, but he's a patriot. Joshua's Country is one of my favorite. It's an editor's choice. My wife is my editor.
Oh, nice.
She's read everything that I've ever, you know, written. She's edited all the books that have been published. And right away she turned around and I was surprised. You know, she's a girl from South Philly. So for anybody out there listening to this, you don't have to love cowboys. Is it a Western? I consider it a modern war Western because it has aspects of the war, right now, in the Middle East and, going into Syria it really is a kind of classic Western. Some of the stories that I loved that I grew up on. So Joshua's Country, definitely something I hope you're going to enjoy. I'd love to get you to hear what you're going to think about it because you've read the Chris De Niro stuff. And like I said, Joshua is outside of the Chris De Niro universe.
Well, don't worry. I've got a pile of 20 books literally on my chair.
Well, when you get
time,
I know you need to get some sleep.
Your book comes. Which is what happened when I got this one. It just stared at me and said, "Read me, or you're going to be in trouble with Chris." And
the fun thing
I
about Joshua,
see,
let me just add one thing: with Joshua's Country is only a novella, so it'll be a short read, especially for you. You read
I could deal with that. Don't worry about
Now, Joshua's Country also was the, and I just reached out, and I can't say too much more about it, but Joshua's Country was the only book I've ever written where I had come up with an act. I normally just write books. I don't write books for screen or anything else. But I wrote this whole story with one actor in mind because I had seen a movie from the actor that he had. It's not even one of his big movies. And Tommy Lee Jones. And Tommy Lee Jones was the person I had in my mind when I created Joshua Jacobs. And I'm managed by I'm represented, I should say, by the same people that Tommy Lee is represented by. So I'm trying to get a book into his hands. He's a very, very private person. He's not you're not going to find him bouncing off the walls in Hollywood. You know, Tommy Lee Jones. Yeah, but I am trying just to pay homage to him, to let him know. I wrote a note and sending him the book through channels just to say, hey, listen, I was very motivated by this one particular movie that he not only acted in, but I think he directed it and he wrote it. So, it's going to be kind of cool. And of course, if he wants to make the movie, Mike and I will write the script
that?
In a heartbeat.
I could swear there's something flying in here, either that or it's outside. I hope it's outside. I have no idea. So if you want to know what to read, New Detroit is fantastic for Hanukkah, Christmas, New Kwanzaa, anything. Through the Fire is another great book, A-List by D.P. Lyle. She's listening, so I have to do this, Marcia. Sorry, she's listening. Guilty Pleasures by Lady Jane Sinclair. And that's all I'll say about who wrote that. It's a really cool book. You'll love it. I loved it. And those are just some of what Fran's read. And I read the new Daniel Palmer, Michael Palmer book's coming out in April. It's called For the First Family. So before we close, where can everybody find out more about you and every single book you've written? And before I do set up another interview for January, for I just read To Be a Seventh-day Adventist by Pastor Michael Jones, and I reviewed the book with the understanding that I didn't review the religious part. I reviewed what I learned, and he just sent me an email to say that I got it, and he loved what I wrote, and this is the first time he's agreed to be on my radio show. So that should be very interesting. So tell us where we can find out more about you and your work.
Well, you, GerardDeMarini.com is the website, so to spell it, just try to phonetically spell it in there, Gerard D. Marini, the G is silent, DeMarigny.com. Or else you can look for me on IMDb. That's all the movie and TV work that I'm doing with Mike Greenberg. And I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I love to be connected. I just had a huge, about another 10,000 people connected with me just from the New Detroit. Because like I said, I hadn't written in 3 years. So I got about 10,000 new friends out there, and we have fun on Twitter. So look for me on Twitter and Facebook and those places.
You're going to see me there too.
Excellent.
I just posted your review.
And I didn't know Marcia was listening. So hello, Marcia. People out there should know
listening.
That Fran and Marcia were probably the number one and number two people that came across my book in 2011 and in The Watchman of Ephraim. And so you ladies are always going to be special to me. It's always fun
to
come back.
She said to say
and,
hello.
Yes.
She's listening, and she said hello. And she said to tell you novellas are A-plus for actors, so you're on target as usual.
Well, that's good to know.
See,
I hope he reads it. I hope I can get it to him. It's not just going through the motions of getting a book into an actor of his, legendary actor's hands is can be a lifelong thing. I don't ever do it. It's not something I'm going to do again. It happened. I wrote it. I love Joshua's Country. I think it's one of the great stories out there, especially for right now. I hope Tommy Lee reads it.
You know something? You never know, because the very first New York Times author that I interviewed, I found the person's website, and I'm saying the worst that'll happen is she won't answer me, and she did. It was Tess Gerrinson, and
oh, wow.
She did my show, and I was like, she's not going to answer, and she answered me, and then of course I had the guts to ask a few more people to do. I even got Steve Berry a couple of times and Michael Palmer before he died and a whole bunch more. And I'm excited because I've got D.P. Lyle on December 11th. But I want to thank you so very much. The sun is shining. It's 30 degrees outside. It's freezing outside. I don't know how warm it is by you. It's 42. It's hot. What do you know?
It's
yesterday
probably in the mid-50s here in Las Vegas, but it'll go up to 70. We have some beautiful weather at this time of the year. So I don't envy your coldness there, Fran.
No, I don't envy it either. As a matter of fact, it's just like there's a chill even inside today. I don't know why. And but I want to thank you very much. I'm going to read the book as soon as I get it, because you know I'm going to do that.
You're
going
to get it tomorrow. I just got heard from Amazon, so you'll have it tomorrow. But you know what? You have so many books to read. Rest your eyes, Fran.
I will try to do that. And also, when I do read it, I will let you know when we could do an interview on this one.
Oh,
I'm sure you want to talk about it.
Totally look forward to it. Always fun talking.
Oh, good. Because thank you so very much. Everyone, have a nice day. And like I said, Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, every holiday, Thanksgiving. Hey, listen, I'm going to Thanksgiving at my brother's next week, and my sister-in-law wants this book. I mean, she's going to grab it out of my hand. And she's wherever I go, I'm serious. I go into the diner, and they say, what do you have for us? You can't come in unless you bring us some books. I go to the doctor's office, and yeah. And for those of you that don't know, my new book is out, came out July 27th. It's called A Daughter's Promise. I'm on a blog tour with Providence Books. They're the best in the whole universe. And I've got 9 5-stars and 1 4-star, because 4.5 stars, because she said I repeated something, which I did on purpose because I had to make my point. I had three doctors that read the book, and it's called A Daughter's Promise, and it's the promise I made never to put my mom in a nursing home, and she had Alzheimer's.
Wow.
So for those of you that don't know what to get a couple of million copies of that. Everybody that's read it said it's a good resource for anyone that has family members that have Alzheimer's. And if I could wish for the new year, everybody, if they ever found a cure and or the proper cause for that disease, that would be a miracle in itself. So I want to thank you a million times. And as soon as I get your book tomorrow, you know I'm going to wind up reading it. It's going to just stare at me and say, Joshua is going to come and get you if you don't read it. And maybe you never know. You just never know. Thank you so much. Everybody have a nice day, and bye.
Bye.